The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
My name is Joe Campo, and I am reading What My Family Should Know in the Event of My Demise by Daryl Z. Grizzle. The passwords for my email and other accounts are in a little moleskin notebook I keep in the center drawer of the desk in my home office. I also keep track of them in a Word file on my computer, titled Passwords. My checkbooks and other financial papers are in the left-hand drawer. My funeral should be a simple one. Nothing too fancy. My favorite scripture passage is Ecclesiastes chapter 3. To everything there is a season. I'd like to be cremated with my ashes spread in the woods behind the house. Feel free to split up whatever belongings I left behind. I know most of it is books and records and CDs that you may or may not want to keep. That's okay. But be aware that some of the Grateful Dead albums, especially the ones in the Road Trips and Dave's Picks subscription series, are now worth over $100 each. I do have a safe deposit box at the bank where I keep a few family heirlooms like grandmother's pearl necklace and great-grandpappy's flintlock pistol that he used in that duel. You'll want to keep them in the family, I'm sure. Whoever takes care of the cats after I'm gone, please keep them together. They're brothers and they shouldn't be split up. If I died alone in the house, and it was a while before my body was found and the cats ate my face, please don't hold it against them. They're just being cats. As you know, I never married and I don't have any kids, unless you count the feral children who live in the woods behind the house. They come up on the back porch occasionally where I leave food out for them. Whenever they see me, they hiss and run away, so don't be surprised if they treat you the same way. I've occasionally mentioned on my Facebook page the loathsome hellspawn that lives in the crawl space under the house. I'm sure most people have assumed that that was just part of my macabre sense of humor. But you should be aware, especially if you intend to sell the house, that it wasn't a joke. He, I don't know his name, is the reason for the two padlocks on the crawl space door. The keys to the padlocks are in the key bowl in the kitchen, where I keep my car keys. He feeds on human flesh, but I found that if I dig up a fresh corpse from the nearby cemetery about once a month, that will keep him sated. The corpses, of course, are already dead, so there's no need for murder, despite what he might tell you. The corpses also keep him from trying to escape and going after the feral children who live in the woods. The shovel and the other grave-robbing implements are on the back porch near the cat food bowl. I can easily fit one dead body in the trunk of my car, and I've been doing that for years. So, if you intend to sell the car, you might want to air out the trunk and use plenty of Febreze. I think that covers the important stuff. But if I left anything out, you can probably contact me through Charlie, the tarot card reader from the coffee house. He's actually a very adept medium, so he should be able to contact my ghost if you have any further questions.
I am Elena Clevenger, and the next story is The Perfidy of Cats by D.M. Krigsman. It was decided at the last and final meeting of the Feline and Canine Human Advisory Council. The minutes show that the decision was carried by the majority with only two dissenting votes. But since the Siamese always disagreed, they were customarily ignored. Most of their equals thought they had an attitude that bordered on unlikable, if not outright evil, so their opinion never counted for much. The first to attempt contact was a stray Pekingese who walked down Broadway during lunchtime, asking for directions to the automat. That brief foray into conversation caused three humans to lose their lives due to heart attacks, two trampled by the crowd, and four headed straight to Bellevue to check themselves in. Finally, a man informed the dog that it had been closed for years, and the two continued to have a conversation about the ever-changing state of eateries. Neither seemed happy with their contemporary choices. The second attempt at contact was much less volatile. An elderly woman, with very little interaction with other humans, was talking to her young Tom about the last episode of Kojak that she had just seen. Perhaps she wasn't as surprised by the talking cat as most people would be, because she thought she was talking to her son-in-law. Young Tom explained that he was really more of a Starsky and Hutch man, but that Kojak did have its finer points. Soon, contact was not limited by numbers that you could count on one paw. It was widespread, and once the panic of the first few utterances died down, people were fascinated by talking to their companions. No longer did they have to guess at which food they preferred, it was the expensive brand, or how often they liked their litter changed. Sorry for the work, but every day keeps things nice and fresh. Canines, with very little resistance, demanded to go without their collars, and most masters agreed. It was hard to leash something you were just discussing the Mets' latest downward spiral with. For a while, all things went smoothly, and an animal rights bill was even voted on in Congress. Unfortunately, there were small pockets of trouble that were threatening to grow bigger. A St. Bernard in Poughkeepsie, who threatened to expose his master's philandering ways to his wife if he wasn't allowed to sit on the couch, especially during football games, was killed by an accidental shotgun blast. Around the country, similar instances were taking place. The animals, powerful with knowledge of their masters, demanded to be heard. They wanted voting rights. They demanded to be served in restaurants. They wanted designer clothes. Politicians, fearing the knowledge that their own animals had stored away about their administrations, passed a bill that granted them subsidized designer clothing. As a special bonus, a subcommittee convened to discuss the feasibility of canine and feline shoes. This is where things started to come apart for the animals. Humans, many of them without animal companions, demanded to know why four-legged furry creatures had an inalienable right to aluminum pantsuits and triple-breasted silk jackets, but not them. It wasn't soon after that the purges began. At first, they were small and spontaneous, and not more than 300 or 400 were destroyed at once, but soon it began in earnest. After a short period of time, the streets were coated in red, and there was enough excess fur just lying around to make quite a few jackets and stoles. A real seller that season was Labrador skin boots. Somewhere, two Siamese sat and shared a pot of tea, feeling very smug.
My name is Mike Rumble, and I'm going to read The Shuffle, Duffle, Muzzle, Muff by Matthew Amati. Unc Unger was boiling his head.
"If a real wizard ye would be," his voice burbled from the roiled waters of the charmed pot, "ye must commit, commit. Many apprentice cometh, wheedling to my stout oak door, born with powers, they say. O maester, teach me secrets, they say."
Oik Smildren, prentice cap, hung awkward off his ears, was still a sentence behind. Commit, he repeated to himself, scratching clumsy letters on a scroll. Torchlight licked up and down the dirty stone walls, illuminating hellish bric-a-brac in flashes.
"They haven't the spine,"
scoffed Unk Unger as his head bobbed to the surface.
"First time ye ask a mewling prentice to sleep on nails, or slay a villain babe, or feed his privates to oracular goats, he fades on ye, runs screaming for the exits." "Haven't the spine," Oik repeated, quill scratching.
He turned pale, recalling his own encounter with the oracle goats.
"Does it hurt, boiling your head like that?" "Of course it hurts," the head bellowed. "But necessity demands, boy. Ye want your father alive again, do ye not?"
"I do, but at such a cost."
"We all want him back, such a fine Lord Mayor he were, and I'll be the one to reanimate him. Before my rival, the Witch of Mud Bend, manages the feat, takes all the glory and the cash."
The head sank. When it surfaced again, it said, "Boy, fetch me the tongs." Unger's headless body felt around and nearly upset a flagon of a substance that emphatically did not like to be upset. Oik quickly placed the tongs in Unger's groping digits. Unk Unger fished his head out of the pot. The eyes were dead milk white. The beard was wet as a drowned cat. There were chunks in the beard. They might have been carrot or something worse. The head spoke.
"Anyone can chuck in a tiger's chaudron or pick up a pennyworth of Turk's noses at the corner apothecary. Weak water, that's what gets you. The real powerful ingredients, boy, will stow that goose penny and listen. The real powerful ingredients are the ones that hurt, that cost you something you'll never get back."
Unger heaved his head back into position on his neck with the tongs. He jostled it this way and that, and muttered a chanson of joining.
"Curry, curry, mutt, etagabanda, poco, afroco, be."
The seams on the neck joined like running butter, although there was still a marked difference between the quick beige of the lower neck and the dead gray of the severed flesh. Unger moved his jaw back and forth. He batted his eyes. He grunted.
"It'll never be the same, of course, this head of mine. Always going to feel soup sloshing in the brain pan. But that's commitment."
His dead eyes fixed on Oik, who dropped the scroll and took a timorous step back.
"Did ye get the supplies I sent ye for?"
Unk Unger asked in a tone that implied he didn't think Oik had gotten the supplies.
I got the slips of you, the howlet's wing, the finger of a babe strangled by moonlight. I could have sent the grocer's boy to fetch me such odds and sods. Ye know what element I ask whereof."
"I couldn't," Oik squeaked.
I mean, how could I? My own sister." "It's needed.
It's barbaric.
Ye feed your own willowaws to the goats, didn't ye? Just 'cause I asked ye to? There are worse things to cut from a person than Willie was, and she's dear to me."
Unk Unger leaned in close. The reek of reanimation made Oik want to retch.
"Why, I told ye about commitment. Ye want to be a wizard? Ye want to bid the dead dance and the dying live? Ye can't go around with these squeams and scruples, boy."
He held up a cruel curved blade.
"Get your sister close. Slice down, slice up. She'll scream a bit, they do. But be ye cold and see the deed through."
Oik Smildren paled. He stepped back. He turned and ran weeping through the door into the rain and the night. Oik ran crying, gagging, stumbling to the shabby hovel where he lived with his sister. His sister was home. She wore her tunic, and it was wet with rain.
"Oh, sister, I have left the service of Unk Unger. Such foul deeds he demanded me commit. You poor thing, come, embrace me."
Oik held his sister close, buried his face in her tunic, wept. For a brief, shocking moment, he felt the cold agony of a blade between his shoulders. The Witch of Mud Bend held up the final ingredient and grunted with satisfaction.
"Well done, Prentice! We'll have the Lord Mayor alive and walking any moment now."
Oik's sister sighed. "My father was dear to me, as my brother. The choice was hard, but I made it."
"Wasn't your brother in the service of that flatulent fake Unger?"
"He was. He hadn't the spine to continue."
"He hasn't any spine at all now,"
the witch guffawed, and she tossed the beastly thing into the pot.
"Ah, that's why I only take women for prentices. The men, they just can't commit."
My name is Emily Chiola, and I will be reading Coke or Pepsi by N.T. Lawrence. The alien was found on the fifth planet, circling a dying star. The creature, like the star around which its home orbited, was fading. Every human in the system fought for a chance to question the creature. However, it was old and tired and said that it would only allow one person to question it. In the end, a drawing was held to determine who would have this amazing opportunity. The winner became an overnight celebrity. He was swamped with messages demanding to know what he would ask the last of this great race. Finally, he issued a statement. He would ask the meaning behind one of the race's most commonly found written symbols. The language of the alien had so far been impenetrable to human analysis. The only information that could be gathered was how frequently symbols were used. For some reason, this symbol dominated their writing. It was discovered carved into stone walls. Long-abandoned holographic projectors shone the symbol. In one prominent instance, the symbol was blasted into the side of a moon so that any passing spacecraft could see it from orbit. For centuries, debate had raged over the symbol's significance. Some felt that it must be the name of the alien's deity. Others felt that it was the unified theory, the long-sought-after scientific explanation of all aspects of our physical universe. A small group of people even began a religion based around the symbol. When the contest winner announced that he would question the alien about the symbol's meaning, the human population waited with bated breath. The day finally came for the man to pose his question. He was wary as he approached the creature. It was massive. Dozens of tentacles sprouted from its bulbous body, a body that seemed to make the very planet shudder as it breathed heavily. It was nearing the end now. The man held up a portable hologram of the symbol and bowed. "Please, Ancient One, I ask for you to tell me the meaning of this symbol, which your kind spreads so widely." The device attached to the creature's side translated his speech into the dull groans of their language. It paused for a moment and then answered slowly. "This symbol is the name of a drink that was widely enjoyed by my people." The man stared blankly at the massive creature. The alien whose species had achieved wonders that the human race as yet could only dream. Before the man could think of anything else to ask, it emitted a hitching rumble that sounded suspiciously like laughter and then relaxed and sank into the ground, becoming still and silent.
I'm Kurt Benrud. This is The Zombies Can't Be Killed with Selfie Sticks by Joy Kennedy O'Neill. My dead girlfriend's face greets me in the kitchen, hollow projected above my burbling coffee pot. "Your memories from 7 years ago," Alexis Five chirps. My heart cracks a little. "Stop reminders," I say. It hurts too much to see her. We broke up long before her cancer, but still, I feel guilty. Alexis 5 is connected to my Fitbit, and it senses my pulse, hormones, and distress. It tries to cheer me up. Your memories. There's me at 7, holding my first puppy. The picture spins above my kitchen table like a specter. Poor, sweet Rusty, hit by a car. Stop reminders, I shout. Noted. Alexis 5 beeps a sickly ping and Rusty fades, his fur going ghostly gray. The system pings again. Remember, it's been 1 minute since you stopped reminders. Good grief, I don't need this glitch today. I'm meeting Sarah for coffee, the new girl from work. She laughs at the same time she says hello and then laughs again. She smells like jasmine. Plus, she likes all my favorite movies. I haven't felt this happy in a long time. When I leave my flat and hear Alexis 5 lock the door behind me, I even want to hum a little. I'm putting the past behind me, starting over. Huzzah, huzzah. I can do this. It's a beautiful day, and people fill the sidewalks and cafes. But everyone is on their tech. People swipe left and right at hollows above their phones, saying, "Sorry, didn't want you to see that." Nervous laughter. Other people shout to their phones, "Stop reminders!" Apparently, some new update has gone haywire. Everyone's connected on Alexis 5, and each automatic update hits us all. You can almost see the data rippling across cities like a spreading infection. I'm relieved it wasn't just my tech going bonky. "Hi," Sarah waves me over to the cafe patio, smiling. "Hey!" Her shirt blushes red. She's wearing mood tech fashion. Her phone chirps, and an emoty heart spins above her purse. "Sarah is feeling excited," the narrative app says. "Oh, my God, so sorry." She takes out her phone and fumbles with it. My own phone chirps. "You visited here 6 times. Claim reward points?" We both struggle with our phones. "Something's up with everyone's," I say. When I try to turn mine off, it bleeps angrily. It won't power down. A group of girls on the sidewalk hold a selfie stick. "New status," they say. "You in 50 years, fun app projects them as old, withering in midair." Sarah doesn't laugh, and I don't either. It's creepy as hell. When the "What's in Your Body" app takes over from there, it projects the girl's sinews and bones, hollowed out skull holes for eyes. The girls scream. "Oh," Sarah blanches, "that's gruesome." Something's happening. All around us, phones chirp and hollow stream. Alexis 5 is connected to everything, even e-jewelry. The Onyx Fitbits, data bracelets, and friendship pinky rings. Everything bleeps, chirps, and shrieks. The sound is deafening. No one can turn them off. I take Sarah's hand. "Let's ditch brunch. The library has a signal-blocking reading room." She looks up from her phone. "Okay," she nods, but she's obviously seen a memory that's upset her. She's starting to cry. Her shirt is blue now. "It's all right," I say. But it's not all right. The sidewalk and tables and streets have become crowded with people. No, not real people. 3D projections of posted memories. Us when we were healthier. Us when we thought we'd get into that grad school. Us when we were hopeful. When we had girlfriends who had no idea of the cancers that were growing inside them, even as we held them, planned lives. I feel like my brain's sliding sideways. Us blowing out candles. Us in videos. Vimeos. Tagged. Targeted. Liked. Hearted. Starred. Emoti haunted. It's all in crisp clarity. Life's Polaroids as an electronic plague. I see strangers as if they're naked. When our dads were alive. When our moms were alive. When our pets were alive. Everyone sees something upsetting. "It feels like they can hurt us," Sarah says. "I know they can't, but..." This does feel threatening, like memories turning on a knife blade, becoming real. We start running down the street. A woman hugs a lamppost, crying. I see phones in the garbage. but Hollows still chase their owners down the block, connected to their devices, even linked to their moodwear shirt tags. Sarah's purse bangs against her side as she runs. Her phone inside bleeps and sends emoji faces spinning in the air. Sarah is feeling scared. Her shirt goes from blue to purple to a blotchy black of terror. We run toward the library. In front of me, my ex-girlfriend starts to spin like a pixelated phantasm. There are pictures of us on the beach, me ogling her bikini and waving the Hang Ten sign. I almost skid to a stop, but Sarah's running faster, pulling my hand. My memories stay one step ahead, but I can't run through them. I pant and try to explain what we're seeing. That was years ago. She's gone. Cancer. It's okay. Sarah's breathing hard, too. Two more blocks to the library. All the years of posting, pinging, and tagging. Why didn't we think it would come back to haunt us? Grief used to be a memory box that you could take out whenever you steeled yourself. A dusty photo album, harmless and passive. One more street to go. A projection of a baby burbles on the sidewalk. Da! A man falls to his knees in response. An old GoFundMe page for childhood neuroblastoma research scrolls above his wrist, along with an obituary. He wrestles with his bracelet, trying to unlock a shackle. We keep running. Soon we burst through the library's door. It's blocking tech works, and our phones go silent. Hollows disappear. Sarah's shirt turns white as a blank page. Suddenly I'm babbling. I can't be counted on. I only visited her once in the hospital. But Sarah's not listening. She's looking out the window. People run. Others record the panic, already hitting post and share. She rests a trembling hand on a bookshelf. I put mine over it, hoping to feel a real connection. I want to feel warm and strong and secure, reliable, but she doesn't meet my eyes. We're fine in here, I tell her. Really. And it's true, I think. This new silence feels like a stone-sweet haunting. Every thought, every memory here has a cover. It's concealed, shelved, spines out with bone-white pages of endless patience, waiting. Yeah, we're okay. I say again, and maybe we really are, here with all the books of the dead. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.